Lord, we do thank you for your love, your grace, your aggressive kindness, just your out after us with your smiles and you delight in us and you tenderly care for us and walk with us in times of joy and times of lament. We could never thank you enough for the freedom that we have in our relationship, our free freedom with you at the costly cost to you at the cross. And we are humbled and quietened by that, and yet we are freed by that. And so we just delight in learning about your heart and your beauty and when you walked among us and got your dusty feet, Lord, just like we have to do every day in our lives. And you walked among us. You know our hearts. You know our challenges. We have a special prayer right now for those that are struggling with things in our midst here and in our families and those that can't come and various things that have come up, Lord, this week and before. We just ask your tender mercy and your touch on that and all the members, the people that have come through here, through our paths. Bless this time for your sake that we might see glimpses of your heart and your beauty and your love and be awash in that at the end of tonight and carry that forward into the week. So we ask this for your son's sake that we might honor him and love him and discover more about his beauty and become more like him, the peacemaker. For his sake we pray. Amen. As we pointed out, all of the Old Testament and the Gospels up until about Acts chapter 5, 6, 7-ish happen inside that red box. So everything happens inside this. In the Old Testament history, when we get to the New Testament, it opens up to Rome. We get into Rome and Asia Minor and Greece as a lot of the Pauline epistles, Paul's literature and things of this type of letters. What we stepped through was basically Abraham. Abraham was over in Sumeria. Basically, he starts out down in here. And all travel, of course, was along the Fertile Crescent. There was water. There was stopping places, you know, to water your animals and things of this type. And so all travel went from this way, and Palestine is the land bridge between the two rich sections of the country of the world in those days, Egypt here, and of course Babylon, Sumeria, Akkadia, Babylon, that whole area here. So everybody had to sort of go through here until we got lots and lots of shipping capability, until sea transport becomes very tonnage capable. Everything's going to go through this land bridge. So there's going to be lots of fighting over this land bridge in history. But Abraham leaves there. He goes up. This is Genesis 1 through 12, 14, 15. He heads out here. God calls him. He goes up here, travels through what would be Syria today, through Lebanon today, into Palestine. He lives most of his life in this area of biblical history. So, I mean, when we started here, we went up through Baghdad almost. Baghdad's on the Tigris. And comes in here. And so most of biblical history is going to occur after Genesis 12 right there, we talked about. And then everything, you know, most of the Old Testament is going to be right here. We're going to have a little bit of Israel and Egypt. That, of course, the Pharaoh and the Exodus and the captivity when they're in servitude, building the store cities for Ramses, Pharaoh Ramses, and things of this type. Joseph is going to be sold into slavery, remember, for 30 pieces of silver, which was about 3 years of a work labor. The going wage over in Babylonia, over there where Abraham came from, was 12 pieces of silver would buy you a year's worth of work from a day laborer. So that's 2.5 years, basically, is what what he was sold for. They carry him down to Egypt. He becomes famous. And then this famous 7 years of plenty, followed by the 7 years of want. And then Israel basically migrates down, 75 of them. They're only 75 people strong when they go they would go along the coastal route into the Nile, this very fertile area where there's shepherds for between 300 and 400 years, somewhere in that neighborhood of time. And then we have the Exodus, where Moses, after a period of extreme infanticide, the Pharaoh decides to kill all the male Jewish babies, Hebrew babies.
to keep the populace under control. And Moses, that's where we have the story of Moses in the basket. He gets put in this basket. It's a covered thing. It's actually pitched. The only time that word for basket occurs in the Old Testament is it's the word for the ark, Noah's ark. That's the same word, and that's the only time it's used. It's covered. It's an enclosure. It's not a boat. It's got open. You can see and navigate and stuff like that. It was just a bubble to be kept in. And they go down 75 strong. They come out about 1.6 million people, which is actually for 400 years is a low number. So God did bless them tremendously in terms of growth. But again, there were forces working against them to control the population through male infanticide. When they do come out of Exodus, they come across the Red Sea, somewhere probably in this area. They make a detour. They go straight down to Mount Sinai, which is somewhere down in here, you know, where Charlton Heston got those rocks, you know, somewhere down here. That's where God, and this you can see this is a very high mountain range there. And then they'll go up here, and they're ready to go into the promised land that God had promised them, oh gosh, 500 years earlier, basically. Oh, longer than that, actually. Much longer than that. Had promised them to go in there, and they get up there, and there's this the episode of the spies, and we don't trust God, and we spin the stuff negatively when something happens. There's this bad scene where the spies go in and look at the land and say, boy, it's a great land, but the people in it are giants. God has led us out of this, led us out of here, out of Egypt, through this miraculous, you know, victory over the greatest nation on earth, most powerful military, but he can't protect us from a few tall people. And so therefore, you know, we're going to lie to the people and say, it's just a horrible place. The land eats you alive, is the phrase in the Hebrew. It just eats, swallows you up whole. And so they spin the goodness of God in a negative way, and the people are already sort of predisposed to do this, that, this, ever. It didn't take much to convince us of this. And so they whine and complain about, so God led us out to kill us in the desert because there were no graves in Egypt. This is why you brought us into the desert. You know, they go through all this kinds of stuff. And God says, okay, well, you got to learn. So back down you go, 40 years in the wilderness. So that's where the 40 years in the wilderness go. And they see miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle and don't get it. Some of them seem to get it. Some of them presume upon it. But at the end of 40 years, then they start trying to go up into the land of Palestine. And as we pointed out, we'll look at trade routes tonight. One of the major trade routes that ran in the ancient world came down right through here on the right side of the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea and goes down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And this was called the King's Highway. Very famous, had lots of Burger Kings along the way, and you know, rest stops and stuff like that. Very famous. And Israel tried to go that way into there. And the nation right here, Edom, and that comes from basically Esau, said, no, you can't go through there. God says, okay, if they say you can't go through, you can't go through. I gave them that land. I don't want you messing with it. And so they end up having to go all the way around Edom and come in this way. And this takes a little longer, more grumbling, more opposition and things of this type. But eventually they're going to make it over into the land of Palestine at the end of the first five books of the Bible. So at the end of the first five books of the Bible, the next book, the sixth book, is Joshua. So it takes them five books to get from where Abraham sort of started over into Egypt, back out of Egypt, and getting back into the promised land that God had promised Abraham to give. All right, so we go into Joshua, and Joshua is going to change the scope. We're now going to be focused for the rest of the Bible, most of it, right here. And there's the top view of it. And let's see. You know the mantra about the distances that we have to learn, right? So from the Dead Sea, the North Dead Sea, to the Sea of Galilee is from Greenville to, that one's the Winona. And from Dead Sea to the Mediterranean Sea is from Greenville to Greenwood. Okay, so very small area of land there. Okay, and we'll look at a bunch of relief maps in a few minutes. But this is the Sea of Galilee, and then the Dead Sea down here. And so the rest of most of biblical history of the Old Testament is going to occur here. And this is where it looks today, remember. We looked at Israel. On the previous chart, this would have been ancient Israel would have been roughly here. So the land that God had sort of promised them is this thing in the white. So in today, what Israel has got is just this area here. See, because they've sort of given the West Bank over to the Palestinians at some level, Gaza over to them. Syria has where Manasseh and Gad and Jordan would be where the tribe of Gad were. So it's a pretty restricted space of where they were when they first started. The distances here, remember, were very, very short. We talked about how here's the same map here. Here's Lebanon. And Lebanon to Jerusalem is like from Clarksdale to Yazoo City. Okay, so that's very short. We talked about it was only about 30 seconds by cruise missile. So if you were at ramp speed at that particular time, that's part of why the pressure is so hot over there and on everybody, the military and everybody's, you know, armed fortresses and things of this type, because it's just very, very close together there. And this is still very, very important land for everybody. And now it's a lot ideological more than anything else. I mean, there's a lot of just, you know, long-standing, you know, feuds and stuff like that. But you can see it's still a very, very small area. Okay, so when we talked about Joseph being sold in a caravan of Ishmaelites, Ishmael, of course, was one of the children of Abraham. He had two kids, one by Sarah, you know, and one by Hagar the Egyptian. He had a concubine. Remember we talked the difference between a concubine and a wife was that a wife's children could inherit the property, whereas the concubine's wife's children could not. They were still treated royally. They got all the protection, all the legal things that a son or a daughter had, but they were not in line for succession. They would be used for being mayors and governors and stuff like this because they were loyal to the bloodline and things of this type. And occasionally, a clever child of a concubine would become the regent because everybody was stupid over in this other side. I mean, so that's part of why polygamy in the Old Testament only happens up at the very high level when you don't know whether you're going to actually make somebody that's going to keep for the quality that you got to have to rule the nation. And so that's why part of the reason why they had so many children and so many extra wives and stuff like that, not to mention infant mortality. You know, only 2 out of 5 children made it to age 5 in the ancient world. So you were constantly outrunning death. Constantly outrunning death here. And so that's part of why leadership groups that were so important, that's why they had, in some cases, God made exceptions for against monogamy, you know, and for polygamy relationships like that. We have a separate problem when we get to political marriages that don't start occurring until a little bit later. So Joseph is one of the 12 brothers of Jacob, who gets renamed to be Israel. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob is the one who God changes his name to Israel. And so Israel is the person, as you know, Israel is a person, and it's the children of Israel that become the nation of Israel, and eventually becomes a half a nation, the northern tribes. Okay, but Jacob is Israel. Well, Joseph is one of the brothers, and Joseph is the one that does the rescue of Israel and Pharaoh. So he's the one that goes in there. He rises up to be regent. Vice regent under Pharaoh, and that's when Israel goes into, or all of Jacob's family goes in, and after that we have the Exodus. So I've already sort of drawn this one, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but they leave the Nile Delta, and here's that Sinai, and we don't exactly know where Mount Sinai is. We've got some good clues, but it's not, you know, there was no little barcode on the thing when we got around to finding it where it was, you know. A lot of good candidates there, and the tour guides know where all the candidates are, and they pick one basically, you know, to take you to when you go over there. So, but it fits all the biblical description, and then they go back up here, and that's that little Kadesh Barnea, the little run of the
the spies, and then they come into Jericho. Now Jericho, now they're surrounded. We mentioned that they were surrounded by all the nations, and most of these are ones, with the exception of the Edomites. Actually, the Edomites, Ammonites, and Midianites, and for that matter, the Moabites, a part of them actually, were not supposed to be expelled from the land. When God said, God told Abraham before his descendants went into Egypt. So Abraham, I mean, you know, Abraham doesn't even have grandkids yet, right? He says, let me tell you what's going to happen. I've made this covenant to make you the father of many nations. And he's childless. He's childless. All of his dad and his grandfather were prolific. They were having kids when they were 100 years old, okay? And very prolific. He has no kid, and he's like 100 years old. You know, he's 80 to 100 years old. And God tells him a simple request, but I cannot. The faith it took to do this just blows me away. He says, and everybody in his troop, see, knows that he's childless. And that's why the Hagar thing happened, and Sarah's barren, his wife is barren. And he says, Abraham, his name at that particular point was Abram. He said, I want you to change your name publicly to Abraham, the father of many nations. And here's this barren man who's probably in total despair of ever seeing God's promise come here. And God tells him to be the fool. Sit there and call yourself the father of many nations. Wow. And he does it. He may have grumbled. I don't know. He may have doubted. But it took a step of faith to do that. It took a step of faith. And it took a step of faith, many things that Abraham did. But he said, your descendants, you know, because of this covenant that we've got, this agreement that I'm just going to bless all the world through your descendants. Okay? Know when he cuts the covenant with him, he says, know that your descendants will be strangers in a strange land. That's when they go down to Egypt. And when the iniquity of the Amorites are full, I can't give you the land yet because the iniquity of the Amorites are not yet full. In other words, these are the Ammonites, Amorites. They're not a nation, they're a group of peoples, okay, like we would be Deltans or something like this. They're a group of people, and they get worse and worse as a culture. They end up doing human sacrifice. They end up doing some of the things we were talking about, sacred prostitution. You know, they get really, really base, you know, in this. But God doesn't give up on them for 400 years. He said, they're not there yet. They're really bad, but I'm holding out. I'm still believing the best for them. But when it gets to a certain point, I'm going to drive them out of the land. I'm going to break up their society. I'm not going to kill them necessarily, but I'm going to break up all their societies so it doesn't self-reinforce itself. I'm going to scatter them across the nations, and I'm going to give you their land. And that's why it took so long for this to happen, is that God was just patient and patient. And finally, he said, okay, time's up. I'm going to evict them from the land. They're my tenants, and I'm going to evict them from the land. But before I give you the land, let me remind you, if you go down that path, Israel, the same thing will happen to you. I am not a respecter of persons. I'm infinitely patient, but I'll draw a line. If you pick up their habits and you do their stuff, guess what? I'm going to drive you out of that land, give it to somebody else too. And that's what happened in the Assyrian captivities and the Babylonian captivity. So there are other nations down here that they're going to fight with. Phoenicia is what I mentioned last time. Phoenicia is where we get our Greek alphabet, the letters Alpha, Beta, Gamma. That comes from Phoenicia. That's where we influenced the Greeks. The Canaanites, of course, are very famous. They're the ones that are the biggest problem. The Philistines are sea peoples. They come in, they migrate in from Crete. Very strong. They have a good high culture. Very, very savvy political and military strategists. They keep Israel on the run for the longest time. But that's where David and Goliath. Goliath was this big, tall Philistine, right? So the other nations around them, Ammon and Moab, are related to Abraham. They are the children of incestuous relationships between Lot and his two daughters. So Lot is the nephew of Abraham, and Abraham and them, Abraham and them are around here, just south of Jerusalem, around Hebron.
And God's blessed them so much. They got so many livestock that Abraham says, we need to just sort of split up. The land can't support all of our flocks. So you look, whichever way you look off into the land, if you like what you see, you pick it and I'll just go the other way. And Lot looked this way. Looked toward Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboah. There are five cities of the plain. Very fertile area down there. And he said, that's what I'll take. And Abram said, okay, then I'll go in this direction, which was Palestine. Lot goes down to Sodom and Gomorrah, and we have a story about the volcanic activity or whatever it was that buried them. They call the south end of the Dead Sea the Sodom part of the sea. They dug under there, but we can't find much because you can't dig too deep. You know, it's ocean, and it's being used commercially. But it's the funniest thing. Pebbles of asphalt just pop up to the top of the water. They just bubble up like a rock because it's so dense. Rocks float in this place. And asphalt, of course, is a light substance. But they'll have chunks as big as a house. Just break off the surface, of the floor, just bubble up to the top. And so Abram goes back into the major land of Canaan. Okay, the 12 tribes, when they go in, when Joshua goes in, they conquer part of the land, and they divide the area up into these 12 tribes. There's 12 tribes, and so they have surveyors. They go through and they say from the rock that's here to the river that's here. And they just do a surveying account of the land. They're already familiar with the land already. I mean, they've been probably trading with them for 400 or 500 years in Egypt. Yeah, I mean, there's constant amount of commerce and trade going on between all these nations through all this time. Nobody lives in a vacuum. People know within like a year of the Exodus. People already know. By the time they get up to, you know, after the 40 years in the wilderness, they get up to cross Jericho. And we've got that Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho song, you know, about the walls come tumbling down. Well, the innkeeper, Rahab the harlot, has already heard. Everybody in the town has heard of these folk and is scared witless about this, you know. And so that's why she tries to cut a deal with them. Because the word is spread. Philistines, same thing. They know all about this. When they captured one of the holy things of Israel one time, they said, don't bring that in here. This is the same God that humbled Pharaoh, which would have been 200 or 300 years earlier. Word traveled fast because that's what you were dependent upon, was intelligence to be able to live then. Okay? So they surveyed the land. They go in. They divide it up. They conquer the... basically, when Joshua goes in, they conquer the backbone. They take the high ground. Let me see if I've got that. They cross at Jericho, and then this mountain, the highest points of the mountain run like this, of the mountain range. And they'll conquer the main cities on the high ground here first, the northern campaign, and then the southern campaign. And then from there, you go literally down the slopes, and you can always attack better from a high ground because you've got the momentum moving. And you don't run into trouble until you get out into the plain area, which is this beautiful, fertile area here. Because the weapon of choice back in these times is the chariot. If you've got a chariot, especially an iron one, you can really clean your enemy's clock if they don't have it. They're just run. You've seen all the movies. Just run over them. You know, just don't even beat the little horn. Just run, slap over them, right? And the chariot was fearsome. And so you were as the enemy when you wanted to attack Israel, who lives up in the mountains. You were always trying to trick them into believing you were retreating, right? So they would come run down after you, and then you'd jump out with the chariot, right? And so the chariots were very fierce. But you always started at the high because you could control all the trade routes. See, everything went across the mountains or across the valleys, and you could control a valley from its mountain. So they divide up to the 12 tribes. And the 12 tribes don't work. So nobody, they had very explicit instructions as to what they were supposed to do to stay together as a team of 12. They don't do these. The book of Judges, every man did what is right in his own eyes, is what it says. And so that Proverbs, you don't trust in your own heart, you trust the Lord. If it comes down to it, if you got to pick between the two, you trust what God's Word said and what you know is the right thing to do.
And they didn't do that. So they said, well, this seems like a better plan this time, is to go ahead and capitulate to the enemy and pick up these bad habits and ignore God. And we'll just try to do this and the best we can, settle for limited objectives. And they don't do real well. At the end of Judges, they're messed up. They're hiding in caves. You know, they're just not doing well. And they ask for a king. And that's where we get Saul. Remember the guy that was tallest in his class, voted most likely to be on the cover of Vogue or something like, you know. And he's the guy they picked for this. Bad choice. But God supported him. He said, hey, I'll go with it. I'll go with it. You, if you show yourself faithful, I'll use anybody. Because that's what he's looking for, just the hard thing. And so it don't matter whether you're good looking or not. I'll even take somebody good looking. He's what he tells us all. I'll take somebody like that that's successful in the part of the world. And so he had a shot. He did okay. He did a brilliant job militarily, by the way. Because he kept all the fighting in the mountains. He knew better to go down to the Philistines. Back in those days, they couldn't have weapons in Israel because they were slaves to Philistines. So when you wanted to get your hoe sharpened, as we pointed out, you had to go down to the coast and pay somebody, a couple of shekels or whatever, and get your hoe sharpened or your, hedge clipper sharpened and mostly your plow sharpened and for doing agriculture. But you couldn't have any iron weapons. Right? You just couldn't have it. And so they were captive to Philistines. And so Saul didn't work out, so God picked somebody that had a shepherd's heart. So he picked David, King David, as the least of among the least of the least, whatever. So God likes the weak to confound the strong. So he picks King David, who does a great job, makes a couple of big mistakes, but overall does a good job. And then he has his son Shlomo, Solomon, which name is derived from peace. And at this particular point, even on this map, everything on that map would be under the control of Israel. Everything at the time of David, at the end of David passing to Saul, everything, the Israelites would only live in their territory, though, okay? But everything else would be under their dominion. They would have vassal treaties. The nations would have to pay them taxes and be border patrols for them and have to come and do, conscripted labor and be in the draft and all this kinds of stuff. So God had promised them that he would give them control over the land from the river of Egypt to the river of the east. And the river of Egypt is the brook of Egypt down around the Suez, a little north of the Suez. And the river of Egypt is the Euphrates up, the river of the east is the Tigris-Euphrates way up north of Damascus, way up in here. So remember, the Tigris-Euphrates comes like this, right? Goes into sort of Turkey. Well, the area that runs from like there to way down here, this is the area that God said, I'll give you all of that to control. But I don't want you to own anything outside of the border I gave you. I gave you just where the tribes are, but you can control that. You can draw wealth. You can bless those people. You can teach them. You can have peace with them, and they'll act as a buffer against all the other enemies too. But you can't have a foot of their land. I've given you this land. This is yours. All right? Divided kingdom. Solomon split his allegiance toward the end of his life. And he became what we call somebody with a divided mind, and God said, I'll divide your kingdom. And that's where we get that divided kingdom. So his son, when he dies, his son tries to take command and tries to be ruthless, a stronger, more centralized government, and they've had plenty of government, and they don't need any more government. They're paying too much taxes, too many conscripted laborers for all the building of the temple and the palaces and all the houses for his 300 wives and all this kinds of stuff. And so there's a slight discontent. And so Solomon's son said, well, okay, just to show you that I'm stronger than my dad, I'm going to be more ruthless than he. My father scourged you, whipped you with whips. I will whip you with scorpions, is what it says. And so the people say, well, then we don't want any part of this administration. I'm sorry, so we will secede. And so the 10 tribes that are fairly smart about this say, forget this, to your tents, O Israel, what share do we have in David? And so that's their cry. They've started a rival kingdom up here, very strong. It's going to be very, very powerful. But Judah still has two The tribe of Judah still has two for the Davidic promise. So there's the divided kingdom, and then what's going to happen? The divided kingdom is about 900 B.C., okay? And then, and here we are with little Judah right here. We're in this area right here. And all these nations are going to start coming and fighting over the land bridge, right? Assyria cranks up, and Assyria, about 640, is going to conquer, own all of this world. But in this land, let me back up here for just a second. You always remember attack from the north, right? You always had to attack from the north because you couldn't get across the mountains in the desert across the east. So you had to go all the way up that Fertile Crescent. And when you attacked Israel or Judah, you came in this area. You came down this, the lake areas, right? Then you would go across this very fertile plain here, the plain of the valley of Jezreel, the valley of Esdraelon, and you'd get over here to sort of the foothills, and then you'd come down the foothills, and this is all plain over here, you know, nice, beautiful valley. That's where the Rose of Sharon, you know, imagery comes from. Beautiful land. And then you would take this, and then you'd try to make your forays into the mountains to take this. So you had to get your base of operations. You could live off the land down there and support your team, because what you couldn't do with your chariots was chase the people out of the mountains. It's hard to run those things uphill. You know, they don't have a low gear on a chariot. Or actually, that's, I guess that's a second horse. But you have to hook up a second horse to get up the hill. But that's not what you do. You don't take those things. What you do is you camp around and you don't let them out until they start. You do what's called a siege, right? You just cut off all the supply lines. They don't have any water. They don't have any food. And after about 2-3 weeks, guess what? They become more compliant. You know, they become willing to negotiate, surrender. And that's what you, that's the way you would do this, okay? Well, in this kind of scenario, when Assyria starts capturing Israel, they're coming from the north. The first part they take is Galilee, which we're going to talk about tonight. Galilee's got the most fertile land of that area, even on hillsides. Beautiful, the density of what you can grow there is great. They take Galilee first, which is where Jesus grows up in Galilee. That's our, most of our subject tonight will be Galilee. And that's done around 740 B.C., somewhere 730 B.C., somewhere in that category. And then the rest of the divided kingdom, right here, which would be the rest of it. And by that time, they've been calling that Samaria. Okay, so King Ahab and Jezebel, you know, that's Samaria. That's the northern kingdom of Israel. That will fall to the Assyrians in 722 B.C. So in 722 B.C., 10 tribes of Israel just sort of disappear because they've really been bad for several hundred years. Really, really bad. They've been, according to the prophets, Elijah and Elisha were the ones up there ministering, trying to call them back. God doesn't do a lot of miracles in the Bible. He's got them concentrated in like 3 different times because that's not his choice method of doing stuff. I mean, one of the periods of miracles are the Moses and the Red Sea. That's our big set of miracles. The next big set are Elijah and Elisha, just trying to keep the little nation together, you know, in the promised land. And then our next set of miracles are in the book of Acts and Jesus, the Gospels. But everything else is more or less quiet. He works through people. He works through quietness. He works through changes of heart, changes of attitude. I mean, that's the way he prefers to do all this stuff, right? And so they get carried off. The 10 tribes leave. Judah's going to fall in 586 B.C., but not to Assyria. So I did that to get to the Assyria chart here. So Assyria grows, they go up to about 650 B.C. They're going to capture the northern tribe of the northern kingdom of Israel. And they've already subjugated Babylon, but Babylon's going to, you know, kick back. And then Babylon's going to grow. They're going to sack Nineveh in 612-ish. Around this time, they're going to go north. And Babylon's down here. Assyria's up here. Babylon's going to go north, sack Nineveh. And Babylon is, it's interesting that Babylon,
they were the most famous astrologers and astronomers of the ancient world. I've got literally in my books up here, I've got charts of their recorded where they noted every little star, every little constellation, every little eclipse. I mean, they got just all these things because they want to know the future, see? And they have little seminaries there. We'll talk about seminaries when we talk Jericho, because there was a seminary at Jericho. But they had, you know, they were the ones that would, like, take an animal and they would, you know, cut it open. You know, they'd sacrifice and they'd cut it open. They would read the entrails, you know, and the liver and this kinds of stuff. That was, you know. And they had, like, seminaries where they trained young little prophets on how to do this. And they had practice organs made of clay. And so they'd take the little bones, you know, I'd see some student there in a seminar, you know, and they'd take a liver, the instructor would pull a liver and a kidney down and a heart, maybe a left thigh, and throw them out on the table and said, okay, Joe, come here and read this. What's going to happen to the king? You know, and they learned to do this. This is the way they practiced, okay? One of the more strangest miracles in the Old Testament happens to King Hezekiah. Hezekiah is alive when the prophet Isaiah divided kingdom. Hezekiah is a good king. He does a good job. And then God tells Isaiah to go tell Hezekiah, you're going to die. Set your affairs in order. Hezekiah, it's a moving scene. He turns his face to the wall and he prays. He said, Lord, I've walked before you this. And, you know, he prays for a long life. And then before, you know, Isaiah makes it even home, you know, he sends him back and he says, okay, I'll add 10 years to your life. And what sign would you like for me to prove this? So Hezekiah wants a sign that God's going to do this. And there's a stairway in the palace, and the sun has got a shadow on it, right? And so Isaiah says to Hezekiah, well, I'll tell you what, first sign, you want the shadow to go this way for, you know, 10 steps or that way for 10 steps? And Hezekiah knows what time of the day. He said, well, it's easy to make it go 10 steps this way, you know, because the sun's moving in that direction. Make it go backward. And that's what happens. We have this strange optical miracle of how somehow light, at least in his palace, we don't know how wide this thing was, but the shadow went back 10 steps on the thing. And he doesn't do well the last 10. It was his time, actually. He doesn't do well the last 10 years. He thinks, because there's been a pronouncement of judgment, he says, well, at least I won't see it. Wrong attitude. You know, wrong attitude. Another good king gets warned that God is going to destroy the nation of Judah. But because the king has been so good, he won't destroy it while the king is alive. He will wait until he's dead before he punishes Israel. The king doesn't say, well, it'll be okay while I'm alive. He goes out and mobilizes all the troops, sends out all the Bible teachers out into the tribes, does his best to save his people. Totally different response to grace. One spills over, one just sort of sits back and, you know, cauterizes one's heart. Just a strange sort of thing. But the Babylonians are watching all this stuff, and it says they sent an envoy over to ask him about this healing and this miracle. See, they noticed something, or they had heard about this, and so, you know, they got the scribes and the visiting professors go over there to ask, what about this thing, right? And then Hezekiah makes a mistake, according to Isaiah. Hezekiah then starts bragging about his wealth. He takes all these people from Babylon, shows them all his fortunes, all his, you know, his money that he's got, takes them in his safety deposit boxes, you know, does all this stuff like this. And then they go back to Babylon, guess who they tell? King and the military commanders. And Isaiah goes to Hezekiah and says, that was not really smart, dude. You know, because they're going to come and get that stuff. And at 586, that's what they do. They come over and 586, they conquer Judah. Judah then goes into captivity. And the land is just occupied by just sort of half-breeds and people that come through. The poor of the land get the land back. We have the Babylonian captivity, in which Ezekiel and Daniel are famous. Daniel and the lion's den, of course, occurs during this time frame. One thing, there were two pieces of... there was one piece I wanted to mention about the Exodus that I forgot last week. When the Exodus goes out, remember we talked about when you're walking around the desert, you don't leave tracks. Your tracks disappear in 5 minutes. So there's no archaeological, you know, stuff about the Exodus. But the first Egyptian historian, Manetho, who died in 300 B.C., so he's a 4th century historian. He's writing, he's an Egyptian priest, and he's trying to write the first history of Egypt. Right? And so he says he's writing from all the records and, you know, and the priestly things and this kind of stuff. And he actually describes the Israel, the Exodus. He talks about the Hebrews and the Exodus. It's documented that way. But what's interesting is the spin that they put on this. Instead of a victorious slave nation escaping and overcoming the more powerful, it says that because they were lepers and so filthy, they were expelled from Egypt. Okay, this was what showed up in the press release, you know, of how they explained the Exodus. And so, at the first century Christ, the Jewish writers who were trying to be totally legitimate, they're trying to say, that's not true. It's just not true. And so that's how we know Manetho wrote this about that. So we have some documentation about that. Let me save the other one for right after when we get to Alexander. Okay, so the Babylonians conquer Judah. Judah goes into captivity. We have the Babylonian captivity. And then the Persians come in and conquer the Babylonians. This is that famous scene in Daniel where the handwriting on the wall is where we get that phrase. He writes, "Meeny, meeny, tickle your parson." You know? Tickle your parson. This is not a good king. This is a bad king that's reigning at this point. He's actually a pretender to the throne, Nabonidus. And he's really bad. And so they call for Daniel to read this. And he says, this night, basically, your kingdom has been weighed, measured, and found wanting, and it's going to be divided, is basically what that means. It's measured and judgment's fall. And it was that night that the Persians literally conquered the Babylonian Empire, was that night. Okay? And so the Persians kept, and the Persians are smart, politically smart people. Instead of moving you to another land, they'll just subsidize your building as long as you pray for them. They're very smart about this stuff. That's part of the reason why they had the largest empire. You know, they were more encouragement people than anything else. You know, they did a better job of letting you go about your business as long as you paid them their taxes and didn't create trouble and stuff like that and prayed for the king and, you know, they were relatively clever. But they go start messing over here with Greece. And they go into Macedonia. And Macedonia is where Alexander the Great is going to come from, right? And he's already a second-class citizen, by the way. The Macedonians were second-class citizens to Athens, the brilliant folks, the smart folks, Athens and Sparta. And they looked down on the little Macedonians that lived across the bay from them. And so Alexander, they're trying to get an uprising together, but they sort of can't get an uprising against their brethren because guess who's on the heels from the other side? The Persians. So Alexander the Great comes into the scene at this particular point. He just does an awesome job. Brilliant young military strategist, has a great team, relatively humble individual. They tried to make him God a couple of times, and he just wouldn't do it. And the study I had for the think tank on how inflated the ancient histories were, you know, when you embellish things of this type, the story is told of Alexander is riding out in a boat with his official court biographer, right? And the biographer is writing accounts of his conquering India, right? And the scene is told where Alexander gets mad. The guy's reading what is, you know, he's testing his draft out on Alexander. And Alexander says, gets mad at the biographer, says, "I'll throw you out of the boat. Nobody's going to believe I killed an elephant with a spear." <You know? laughs> And he says, "I'll lose all credibility for all the good things that I legitimately did. Don't put this hint about me killing an elephant with a spear." You know, so it's just an interesting story about Alexander. Well, he did conquer Egypt, but what... But I wanted to mention that there's a story that after he's done some of this, as he's going down this land bridge, right, to go into Egypt on one of the trips, Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, tells an account that that as Alexander is coming down, the high priest from Jerusalem has got the Torah, he's got his, you know, the full dress regalia, you know, got all the robes and all the turbans that they had and all that kind of stuff, and everybody's decked, all the priests are decked in white linen. It looks like, you know, a Christmas ceremony or something. It's just beautiful. And they come down from Jerusalem, and he sees them off in the distance. And then they come to honor him as king and as emperor, and to ask for concessions for Israel. Okay, and they come and they show him in the book of Daniel that it's prophesied that he would take over the world, because there's a prophecy of four beasts or something like this. I forget how it runs, and the interpreter to Daniel says the third king is the king of Greece that will overcome the king of Persia, and then his kingdom will be divided and won't be strong. And so the high priest goes out here to show him that, hey, this is all part of God's plan. And in this passage in Josephus says that Alexander, before the priest got to him to read that passage, he bowed down in honor and then recounted that he had had a vision or a dream like three nights before or something like this, where he had seen the dress code of the high priest in this dream. He didn't know what it was about, but that some man would tell him that he would be the emperor of the world or something like this. And that's what Alexander tells the high priest. Now, Josephus is fond of exaggeration, okay? But we don't know a lot of places where he just flat makes stuff up. You know, he'll inflate the numbers of, you know, how many people he, you know, was in charge of in the army and all this kinds of stuff. But he doesn't make stuff up. And so there are a number of scholars that believe that's a legitimate account. And of course, because he gets concessions from the Jews get concessions from him, and they're exempted from tax. They're also exempted from the standard taxes of Rome. They get all these strange concessions over these years, even though they're under the domination of other empires. Well, at the end of Alexander's over here toward India. He dies at an early age. The nation splits up on all his generals. There's a lot of fighting over his... he didn't have a good succession planning program. And that nation breaks up into all these different states. There's the Parthian Empire, the Seleucids, and the Ptolemaic, Ptolemy. And these are the two, remember, these fight over the land bridge over and over and over and over. Now remember, so between 300... and the Romans, and about 150, 175, there's 150 years before Israel becomes independent again, where we mentioned that they changed ownership like six times. You know, eight times they changed who was the boss. And then we talked about if somebody rode up in a military uniform and said, "Who do you serve?" The only answer was, "Oh, you know, who you do." You know. You know, the obvious one, the one that you support. Because you would never know. It was like the old job back in the reorg days where if the boss calls, get his name. You know, so, I mean, it was just that level of turnover. And so they go back. Well, they finally get independence. Finally the Jews revolt, the Maccabean revolt. They become independent for almost 100 years. Well, a little bit more over 100 years. And they actually have an independent state the first time since the Babylon. All right. So, there's a bunch of fighting. They're an independent state. These Maccabean, the Hasmoneans, they're called. You know, they do a fairly decent job. But then toward the end, there's a fight among the family. The king dies. The mother runs it until she dies. There's two children, two sons that fight over the kingdom. And they're not getting along. And they both ask the Romans, independently, not knowing, they both ask the Romans to come help them. They don't know. You know, they both have their moments. And so this is like, you know, what's that little story about the gingerbread man and the fox? You know, I'll give you a ride across the river or something like this, right? And that's what happens. So Rome sits there and says, yeah, I'll be happy to intervene. And when they intervene, it's all over. They take over the... it falls. Rome conquers Palestine in 63 B.C. Okay. And the first king we get in there after a couple centuries is Herod the Great. And he's an Edomite. And he's married. Even worse, remember, the Jews didn't get along with the Edomites because they were always fighting during the United Kingdom. Okay, and it's even worse, he's married to a Samaritan. I mean, you can't get any lower than that.
you know, in that particular world. And he gets the king because he helps Rome against another attack. Okay. Now he's going to bring us in actually to Galilee. Okay, so we now get here to the cities in the childhood of Jesus. Remember, he's born in Bethlehem, but that's a fluke, sort of. He's supposed to be Bethlehem, but his folks are from Bethlehem. They've moved to Nazareth. He would have been born in Nazareth had there not been this census thing that Augustus Caesar decried. And so, lo and behold, we've got to drop everything we're doing. We've got to go back down to Bethlehem to fulfill this prophecy in Micah 5:2. For goodness sake. You know, that out of you, Bethlehem, will come he who would be ruler of Judah. So, 600 years before this, one of the prophets, right around Isaiah's time, Micah has that prophecy in Micah 5:2 that prophesies that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Okay? Isaiah is also prophesied that out of Galilee, the land that is in darkness, out of you will come the light. Okay? And Galilee, remember, was that country that was first gone. Syrians captured them first. And they were emptied of the Jews, and all these half-breed folk came in there, and they've always been the underdog since then. They've always been looked down on until the Jewish revolt a little bit later. So, Bethlehem and Nazareth, these are cities in the childhood. We're going to mention about the trip Jerusalem because of the Persians. We have to cover that. And of course, remember, there's the flight to Egypt. Remember the story about the little four-year-old Sunday schoolers that have to draw their pictures of their favorite Bible story. And where the little kids draw this airplane and this stick figure at the front. And they're saying, what Bible story is that? And that's Pontius Pilate and the flight in Egypt. My favorite on that, by the way, is, I know I've told you before this, but it's in the one where they had the kids draw the picture of their favorite hymn. And this was like an 8-year-old class. So in this 8-year-old class, one of the kids had this picture of this grizzly bear that was just big grin, but he was a cross-eyed, you know. And the person said, what is that? And I said, that's Gladly, the cross-eyed bear. That's my favorite out of all the ones. Okay, Pontius Pilate and the flight to Egypt. So, and we'll cover that in just when we get into the story. So these are the cities we're going to look at in the childhood of Jesus. And in the ministry, now he ministered in a number of cities, and we just can't cover them all. But Nazareth, he's going to grow up there, be a young man there, and have a ministry there. Capernaum is where he's going to spend most of his ministry as his headquarters around the Sea of Galilee. Sychar is the place where he's going to meet the woman at the well. And we talked about in Samaria, when you traveled, the land was divided, remember, into Galilee, Samaria, and Judah, or Israel. And because these people were considered so unclean, observant Jews, instead of going through those when they had to go to Jerusalem for the feast, the Passover, and things of this type, they would go down to the River Jordan, cross the River Jordan, come down the River Jordan on the other side so you wouldn't catch the uncleanness from those people. And then they would cross at Jericho and then go down 14 miles roughly here, not quite to Shaul. From Jericho to Jerusalem. But this is the sort of unclean place. Sometimes they went through it. But one time Jesus goes through, we have the woman at the well. Jericho we're going to talk about, which is the last week before his life, before the cross, rather. We're going to talk about some of the background of Jericho. We mentioned it's the oldest walled city in the world. We're going to look at the trade maps. It also has one of the waterways in just a minute. Like I said, Jericho also has a seminary, which is the city, the sons of the prophets. It's like the Babylonians had a seminary that did where they'd throw the little livers and, you know, different shaped livers and stuff like that. They had a school of 50, we had at least an enrollment of 50 there. But they had seminaries at Jericho, at Bethel, up at Carmel, which we'll talk about. Okay, so here's a relief map and the great sea of Israel. Of course, that's looking northwest or something like that. And a couple of places I want to point out here. Here's Nazareth. It's between two valleys.
when the armies would come down the north, remember I was talking about, or for that matter, trade caravans. You know, anybody that had to travel with wagons or chariots or something like that, they're, of course, going to come down this valley, right, from the north. They're going to go past this little area called Lake Hewlett. Here's the Sea of Galilee. At this point, they can go any number of ways to the sea. So there's several little valleys. You can see in between, like, the mountains there, right? It'll go in here. You could go through here. There's a pass here. Or you could go all the way down and go back up this way, a little longer. Okay. And Acco Ptolemais is one of the major port cities of the world, the shipping of the ancient world. That's where all the Greek and Roman harbors are going to be, at Acco Ptolemais. There are other cities, Joppa, Caesarea, Gaza. These are major port cities too. And then you would go into this plain of Esdraelon, or the plain of Jezreel. Beautiful, we'll look at that. And there's a pass here. This is the main pass that you would go through here. And it's guarded by a town called Megiddo. It's a beautiful plain we'll look at. Just, you can just see for miles on this plain. And there's this mound right in the middle. That's this military fortress. And it guards this plain. And all the major battles of the Old Testament are fought there. And Megiddo is where we get the word Armageddon. Because the picture of the great battle at the end is in Armageddon. It's on that plain, is how it's described, where all the big battles are fought. And that's where we get Armageddon. And Megiddo is that fortress. Solomon built it up. It's another very ancient city. Okay, and it's very impressive. It's built for a fortress with its own water reservoir and things of this type. And it guards one of the main passes before you get into that beautiful plain area where you can travel easy and the caravans can go. And the caravans can go to Caesarea for shipping. Joppa is, of course, where Peter, Jonah, when he tries to run from the Lord, he goes and gets shot, goes and gets shipping at Joppa to flee to Tarshish. But this is a beautiful, and this, of course, is the Jordan Valley. The Jordan River runs here. It runs all the way here, but it runs down here. And you can see there are a couple of places to cut across, but there's a lot of just total mountain in here. And this is the backbone of the country. And there's a watershed. Here's Jerusalem. Hebron is where Abraham raised his family. That's where Sarah was buried. That's where he negotiated and bought the plot. The only piece of land he owned in the promised land before he died was one he bought for a grave for his wife. Right, Lachish, and down here we start getting into fort cities. Once you get down to right about in here, this area here becomes a place of forts. Because your attacks are either going to come up here, or they're coming from the south from Egypt. Because they're constantly being fought between Assyria, or the north, and Egypt. And so you had to defend the people coming up the hills, or up the hills here. One wanted to set the siege to you. Okay, that's a good relief map. We'll leave it with there. There's Tyre and Sidon. That's a very famous city as well. It'll show up in our history as well. Jesus will actually make a trip up to Tyre.
Scale on the map. How far is Jericho from Jerusalem?
14 miles. 14 miles. Okay, Philistines are going to live along the plain. They're shippers. You know, they got good ships, things of this type. Okay. All right, trade routes. We got to do one thing on trade. This is a big map of trade routes. So you see, we've got Egypt. We've got Sumer, which is Babylonia. This is going to be Assyria. And here's that. The red right here is that King's Highway. See it? So there's the Gulf of Aqaba here that comes into the Red Sea, and there's the King's Highway that goes up all the way up to Damascus, which was one of the major shopping marts in the world. And then you have the Way of the Sea, it's called, via Maris. It goes along the sea of Palestine. It crosses at Galilee. It crosses at Capernaum, where Jesus is going to have his operation. And then it's going to go up and it's going to meet at Damascus. And at Damascus, you would either go this way to go into Babylon, or you'd go north to sell into this area. Okay? And those are your really big trade areas. There's a smaller one, of course, trade route that goes across the desert, across the mountains. And normally you'd do that if you had camels, large camels, caravans, long provisions. And then, of course, you've got numerous sea routes. But you can see the importance of this land bridge, if those are the big ones. If those are the big ones, they all go through here. And they all go through just in Israeli territory. See, that's just northeast of the Sea of Galilee. So here's just the northern part. Here's our King's Highway. They're coming up from here. There's our Dead Sea and our Sea of Galilee. There's the King's Highway going here. There's Damascus, that market. And here's the Way of the Sea. And you could go here if you had trade here. And it goes here, and it's going to cross that through one of those passes. It's like guarded by Megiddo and fortress cities there. It's going to go across the plain of Jezreel and cross. There's little Nazareth right there on this thing. Okay, and it's going to come dip through the. You're going basically at the foot of the mountains. You don't go to the valleys because they drop too fast. You'd go the spurs on the mountains. You'd cut a little road just like you would in, you know, a lot of our transportation. You'd go on the side because of gully wash and things of this type. And then you're right there at Capernaum, and you'd either go this way. That's the major way, but you could also go this way. Okay, you'll see here's Jericho, and Jericho's got the main thoroughfare over to the King's Highway. Okay, and it's got one that goes down to Jerusalem and one that goes up to Bethel and Samaria, which is where the capital of the Northern Kingdom was. The Northern Kingdom's rival capital relative to Jerusalem was from here to Cleveland. You know, and they were constantly fighting here, actually between Shaw and Cleveland. But you see the trade routes here. But look how many of them go. Here's that echo, that bay. And look how many of them go through Galilee. See, this is Upper Galilee. Here's one that goes to this area. And Sepphoris that we're going to talk about first is right there. Cana and Nazareth are all in this area that he grows up in. Okay? That's the main trade routes. You can see that, you know, there's some that go across every little... Anytime there's a valley, you make a road. I mean, that's, you don't want to go up and down the hills unless you're trying to burn calories and do aerobics. And so there's also... There's this road that's called the Road of... The Way of the Patriarchs. Because this is the highest point in the mountains, and this is going to go through Jerusalem and to Bethlehem and Hebron. That's where all the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacobs would have traveled up and down this road when they were pasturing, when they were negotiating with farmers. Okay? As you see, this is Samaria and Judea, and here's the Galilee that we're about to dive into. Okay, here's another close shot of that. I just want to show you the cities. Here's that plain of Esdraelon. Here's that port city. I should mention right here is Mount Carmel, that beautiful, beautiful mountain. It's where the Mount Carmel is. It overlooks the sea. It's where Elijah had the battle with the prophets of Baal. You know, when the Northern Kingdom has gotten really, really bad, the Northern Kingdom is here. So down here at Samaria, further south than that, the capital is down there. The capital is down here. But they take all the prophets of Baal, go up here. Elijah challenges them to a duel, basically. And so they go up there and they say, okay, you got your 400 prophets. I'm only one of the prophets of the Lord left because you've killed them all. Jezebel, the Queen Jezebel, put all of as many of the Lord's prophets to death as she could. One of Ahab's assistants was a God-fearing man, a military person. He hid 70 prophets in a couple of caves and saved their life, fed them during their days of famine and drought and things of this type. But it comes to a head here. So all Israel, all of the Northern Kingdom goes up here. There's this just hilarious scene where there's 400 prophets of Baal and there's versus Elijah, right? World Wrestling Federation, you know, whatever, right? And they've had a drought for 3 years. There's no water, right? So they build two altars. So he says, you build an altar. I put a bull on it. I'll build an altar. You go first. And the God that answers by fire, let him be the Lord. Let's worship the one that actually does something here. Everybody likes that plan, especially all the populace. The audience just loves this. You know, they're dying to see some, you know, it's a good, you know, we ain't seen anything like this in a long time. You know, they're away from home. And so the 400 prophets of Baal, they get to go first. Elijah says, you go first. And they start early in the morning, and they just singing and dancing. And as the custom, they would cut themselves because their gods liked blood. You know, they were sort of bloodthirsty. That's part of why the blood taboo was so strong. They would cut themselves. God said, don't ever do this. You know, I'm after health. You know, I'm after your heart, not after your blood, dude. You know, and so they would do this and whip themselves in a frenzy. And they went all day. And then it says in the Hebrew, and Elijah taunted them in midday. And he's got this taunt. Well, maybe you should cry a little louder. Maybe he's asleep. Or maybe he's away on business. And the Living Bible says, maybe he's on the toilet. You know, because there's a phrase that says, maybe he's gone aside. In the Hebrew, that's used for when you would go aside and use the bathroom. And so it may be that Elijah says, well, cry a little louder. You know, maybe he's using the toilet. You know, and so they go till the time of the evening sacrifice. And then they sort of give up and say, my turn. And so Elijah then says, bring three giant 55-gallon drums of water. So they bring water in a period of drought when water is scarce. And he pours it on the sacrifice. The first one, he says, bring a second one. He pours the second one on, soaks all the wood. What he's doing, obviously, is precluding an objection. Well, it just caught on fire because it was so dry. The third one he drenches, and it fills up the ditch that's around for fire control. There's water all there. And he gets back, instead of whining and complaining for 6-8 hours like the other team has done, he issues like a four-sentence prayer. You know, four-sentence prayer, and fire comes down, you know, consumes the sacrifice, consumes the altar, and licks up all the water in the ditch. Right? And then the Israelites say, okay, the Lord, He is our God. They're impressed. They do this. And then there's a whole separate thing about God's grace to Ahab, this horrible king. At that point, once the people are back, sort of, at least they're headed in the right direction, he tells the king Ahab, he says, go ahead, you better get a early start because I'm going to turn the water loose. God's going to turn the water loose now. And there's going to be a flood and your chariot's going to get stuck in the mud. Because God's going to now do something to help his people with the flood. Okay? So Mount Carmel. So here's Nazareth. Here's some forest that we're going to talk about next. Nazareth, of course, is... this is only like 3 miles. Okay? Cana is going to be maybe 10 miles or maybe 9 miles from Nazareth. Here's Capernaum, where he's going to move his ministry from Nazareth to Capernaum, because that's where Peter, James, John, Andrew, they all live there. That's where the sons of Zebedee, they have exceptionally successful fishing ventures there. And we're going to look at the architecture and some of the stuff there. Okay. I'm going to skip that. We don't need this. Okay. Now here is looking from in the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, we're in the Mediterranean Sea, and we're looking, this is north, south, east, west. Okay? So we're at the Mediterranean Sea. We're looking over at, it's almost like we were at Mount Carmel, and we're looking over at the Sea of Galilee. Okay? So that's the Sea of Galilee. This would be Capernaum that we just saw on that map. And here's Nazareth. See, it's up in a mountain. Here's the forest. It's on a hill. And here's Cana. It's on the other side of a plain. See here? And you can see the roads. These are modern roads, but they're built on ancient roads. And here's this road that goes from Acro Ptolemais, from the port city, over to Tiberias, the capital of Galilee at that particular point. You see it goes within, here's a 10-mile scale. So Sepphoris is only a mile or two off of that. And Nazareth is only 3, maybe 4 miles off of that. And Cana is only, you know, 7 miles from Nazareth. Okay, so the first set of miracles is going to occur at Cana, the turning of the water of wine. And Nazareth is where he announces his ministry to his own people and they try to kill him. Okay, so Sepphoris is the first thing we're going to talk about. And now you can actually turn in your syllabus to the first page in the second section where you actually have the text, page 1 of 51. And I'm not going to read all the painstaking detail of this, so I'm going to highlight it. But I've got some of the stuff already highlighted in bold there for you. But this is the Sepphoris. And let me hit the highlights first, okay? Sepphoris is built as a Greek city by Herod the Great. So remember, Herod the Great takes over. He builds Sepphoris as this beautiful city. It's totally Greek. It's got an amphitheater. Now this is, remember, it's built on a hill. Sepphoris comes from the word bird, like bird perched on a hill. We think that's where its name came from. And it's, you can see it's just above a hill. It's about a hill about 250, you know, maybe 250 meters high. It's not real high as a hill, but it's perfect to defend an area. See, you're at the high ground, you could withstand that. These are the ruins, you know, that they're working on, trying to dig up. You can see here's a plot of houses. We're going to zoom in just a second. There's a plot of houses. The main stuff is up here on the top of the tail, the top of the hill. And here's the same, here's the shot. And so this is a fortification palace type house. And if you look here, this is a theater. See it? See the stadium seating? Can you see that? And this is a totally Greek architecture. You can see, we're on the wrong side here. But these are like housing remains, the walls of houses, the base of that. And so this is built up very, very high. It's built under Greek. Herod the Great builds this as a totally Greek city. Okay? It's a pride and joy. There's just another shot. And here you can see the housing areas again, a little bit better. See, there's some there. There's some over here, some structures here, and it was fortified, so it might have had a wall, but generally, a lot of people lived outside the wall. You know, as a farmer, you could only walk in the mountains about a mile and a half, is what they use as a catchment area, as they call it. In the hills, Your farming distance, you could only walk like about a mile and a half there and a mile and a half back. So that defines the area that you can sort of farm as an individual before you have tenants that live out on the land. You got more like two and a half miles in flat land because you can walk it faster. It's not as difficult to do for you or your animals. Okay, so there'd be people that lived on the outside, along the side of the hills, down at the base, and things of this type. Okay, Herod the Great builds this. Okay, and at his death at 4 B.C., so there are two main Herods in the life of Jesus. There's Herod the Great, and there's Herod Antipas. Okay, Herod the Great is the one that lives, that Jesus is born during his life. He dies. He's the one that kills the babies in Bethlehem, the two-year-olds. He's the one that is terrified of the Messiah because he's king. Okay. He's going to die at 4 B.C., which generally means that Jesus was born in like 4, 6 to 7 B.C. Okay? Just because of the way the calendars worked out. So, okay? So Herod the Great, he's going to die. His kingdom is going to split into like four parts. One of them is going to go to Herod, one of his children called Herod Antipas, who is going to control Galilee. And that's going to be the one that wants to see the miracles. Jesus performed a miracle. He's going to want to be the one in power when Jesus is crucified. Remember, at the last in Holy Week, Jesus comes before Pontius Pilate for the trial, and they say he's a troublemaker. He started making trouble in Galilee, and he's brought his trouble here. It says when Pilate heard that he was from Galilee, he thought he'd pass the buck to Herod. Herod was in the city for the day. He said, well, send him to Herod. He's a Galilee. Herod's in charge of Galilee. I'm not in this thing. He knows he's in trouble. He's not going to make anybody happy by dealing with the Jesus issue. Okay? So Herod gets, he says, Herod wants to see Jesus do a miracle. Remember in the pop culture, Jesus Christ Superstar, they have that song where, do a miracle, walk across my swimming pool.
You know, that's the only line I remember from that. You know, he just wanted to see the miracle. Didn't care whether he was the Messiah or anything. You know, no depth at all. He was a very superstitious person. He was the one who had John the Baptist beheaded. And when Jesus was doing miracles, he said, John the Baptist has come back to life. I just knew it. You know, he's a very superstitious individual. Okay. But when Herod the Great, who builds this according to a Greek format, dies, there's this rabble-rousing group of Galileans that revolt. So they come in and take over the city and they say, well, we're going to be independent again like we used to be under the Maccabees. And so they revolt against the Romans. Now Herod Antipas, the son, has got theoretical control over this, but he doesn't. Now he's busy working in other parts of his, you know, kingdom. And so Sepphoris revolts to take independence. Well, the Roman governor of Syria, the big guy, you know, the guy that's running that region of the country, comes in to Sepphoris and burns it, sells all the people into slavery. The bad guy, Judah of Hezekiah, son of Hezekiah, escapes. He burns the city, sells everybody into slavery, and then raises the city, just tears it all down. Okay? Herod Antipas comes up and says, well, I like this place. I'm going to rebuild it. And I'm going to go bring people from all over Galilee to come help me build this. So I'm going to need carpenters. Are there any close by? Like 3 miles away in Nazareth? Could be. So he builds the city after a Roman format, which still has, you know, Greek features to it, but also has the Roman bathhouses. It has the Hippodrome. You know, it was probably a little small for a Hippodrome, but it was totally a Roman style city. And he's starting to build around in the 70s. He's starting to build it again in, you know, right after that, which would be about 0 BC, right at the changeover there. He starts rebuilding this thing. So Jesus is 7, probably around this time. And at 7, the city is sort of, at 7 BC, Jesus is 14, okay, the city's been built. So they used probably Joseph, the carpenter. They brought laborers in. We know that they've had laborers come in from all over Galilee. So there's a good chance Jesus grew up in this environment seeing this. And then when 7 AD hits, and Jesus is like 14, this rabble-rousing Judah, son of Hezekiah, comes back, plunders the city again, taking weapons and stuff like this. And so another Herod comes in and puts that fire out again, but then still makes Sepphoris, it doesn't raise it to the ground. But that messianic fervor of, like, we want to be an independent nation again, God promised us this, got the Sepphorians in trouble twice, right? And everybody around there would have known by the time Jesus was 7 that you don't make claims that you're the king of Israel. You don't do this. And that's part of the problem he's going to have when people start wanting, when he's never going to say, I am the Messiah. He never declares that to except twice. Once, the night he's to die. And the only time he tells that to anybody else is to that little Samaritan woman at 12. Everybody else, he makes them say it, you know, so they get that that eureka when they sit there and when it dawns on them, instead of him saying it, and they just sort of passively take it. Okay, and so you can see when the disciples are start saying, "Is this the Messiah?" The people who have land and power, they're going to say, "Quiet, quiet! I don't want the Romans in here again." You know, just been there, done that. You know, bought the shirt. You know, saw the concert, bought the shirt, T-shirt, and I'm out here. You know, and so Sepphoris is this place where a totally Greek city, and then it's Roman as Jesus is growing up. And Jesus, of course, continues to grow up there, right? Even after they finished building the city. Now, one of the things that they had there that's interesting is they had Greek theater. They had a Greek theater. Romans loved Greek theater, and they were big theater fans too, and so they had Greek theater. And there's a word that Jesus likes to use when he's talking about the Pharisees, the legalists, the abusive religious authorities, as opposed to the Nicodemus and Josephus of the world. He uses a term that was a term for an actor on a Greek stage, where they played a role, and they played a role not for deceit, but they played a role for an audience.
And that word is hypocrite. That was the word that you described. That was the technical term for a paid actor in a Greek drama, right? And so Jesus would have seen these people pretending to be something they weren't for the crowd, right? And he said, that's a word I'll be able to use in 20 years. You know? And so when he gets around it, he's describing some of the pomp and circumstance of the religious leaders that are lording over the people that wouldn't help them at all. He said, oh, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You hire somebody to go, a little bit of hyperbole here, you hire somebody to go in front of you in the streets with a horn to blow to draw attention so you can walk humbly by with ash and show how humble you are. You know? And he uses that word hypocrite. You're a play actor, and you're not just deceitful, you're deceitful for an audience. You know? I mean, it's worse than our just regular hypocrite. You know, this is doing it for show. And that's, he would have seen these things. He would have learned Greek. He would have had to know enough Greek to do business there. You know, and he'll have to know Greek as a, working with the crew over in Tiberias in the Sea of Galilee a little bit later. So Sepphoris does not occur in the text. It's not even mentioned. And so on page... it's page 5. Page 5. The paragraph right before we get to background of Herodium. Oh, gosh. Jesus lived out his life. See that one? Jesus lived out his life within an area roughly 50 miles wide and 150 miles long, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. Apart from Jerusalem, the places he is reported to have visited are not important to the secular history of the region. He ignored Sepphoris, the most prominent city in Galilee at the time. It was also the capital. It's described by Josephus as the ornament of all Galilee. It's our shining thing we're most proud of. Tiberias, which is on the Sea of Galilee, is the dominant port on the Sea of Galilee. Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of Palestine, was one of those port cities. And Samaria Sebaste, which is a longtime provincial city, which was the capital of the northern kingdom. We don't have any record that he went through there. When he came through Samaria, he sidestepped it and went to that woman at the well, which is not too far from it. It's only like about 8-10 miles. But that's a day's journey, you know, by foot in the mountains. Probably because of their non-Jewish care. He was raised in the humble village of Nazareth and lived there until about 30 years of age. Capernaum became the center for the Galilean ministry. He passed through Samaria on occasion and ministered in Perea. Perea is Transjordan. Perea is across from Jericho, basically. That strip that belonged to Israel, you know, where Ammonites, Moab, and Edom on that side of the river, on this side of the Jordan, that is Perea. So Herod Antipas had that area, Galilee, up there around the Sea of Galilee, and had that across from Jericho on the other side of Jordan. Herod's brother, Philip, had the northeastern part of Galilee. And that's the one where Herod takes Philip's wife, right, and shacks up with her. And that's what John the Baptist gets in trouble for, accusing him of marrying his, you know, his brother's wife. And they're not even divorced or separated or anything. They're actually kin. There was a lot of incest. We talked about this at the, you know, when we covered the Christmas season. There's a lot of incest within the city. That's part of why we think Archelaus was insane, was from interbreeding. And he got replaced by Pontius Pilate. But that's another story to be told another time. We're not going to obviously get here.
Understanding you correctly, the reason we're starting with Sepphoris is because it is a mention.
It is a mention.
But it is closest to Jesus'
right.
earliest childhood.
Right.
You think it's because his dad was
right.
confident.
Right.
That this is where you may
have gained its greatness. Right. Right. And see, the other thing is that we're going to see when we get to Bethlehem, which is the next topic, which is next week, obviously, that, remember, Joseph and Mary are from Bethlehem, which is down, you know, down just south of Jerusalem, 8-10 miles. Okay? And they go up to Nazareth. There was a migration up to Nazareth, you know, before the time of Jesus. Well, it might have been part of the building stuff. It wasn't the second building, because the second building didn't happen until after Jesus was born. You know, Herod the Great had to die for the Romans to come in and level the city, with the rebellion, and then for Herod's son, Herod Antipas, to start rebuilding it. But that's where we start, because he would have gone through Sepphoris when he went to Cana. He would have constantly gone through this, but all of his ministry were out in the little places. All the ministries were out in the little places. And he didn't go to the pomp. I mean, even Tiberius. Tiberius is... When Herod built Sepphoris, as the ornament of all Galilee, apparently he got bored with it or something, and he built another one, Tiberius, which is when you go to the Holy Land, it's right there on the Sea of Galilee, and he's named after the emperor, Roman Emperor Tiberius, who was one of his sponsors back in Rome, and that was where the capital was. And Tiberius is famous because it's they get to build in the city, and he's going to set that up, and lo and behold, they discovered it's built on a cemetery. And the Jews said, well, I can't go there. How am I going to live there? I can't work there. But he's already got too much sunk cost in the thing, so he finishes the project. And eventually they do get there. They do end up moving into Tiberias because he gives them land grants. Royal land grants. And they, funny, they end up there. And that's where part of the Mishnah is written. And after the New Testament is over, and we a lot of the sacred Palestinian Talmuds, some of the Jewish literature, all the famous rabbis of the 2nd through 4th century, they all live in Sepphoris, and they live in Tiberias. So a lot of history there. Like I say, it's going to intersect. We're next going to go to the Bethlehem and Nazareth, because there we actually have biblical passages now. But like I say, he would have passed through Sepphoris. He would have seen the world there. He would have seen all the Greeks come through, all the Romans come through, all the Jews, all the Samaritans, everybody came through because he was on that trade route. He was on that trade route. He could just sit back there. Remember how he liked to sit? He liked to sit and watch things and comment. So he would sit there and he would watch all the people putting money in the treasury at the temple. He would sit there. This is one of the things you learn about parenting and mentoring and stuff like this. He's sitting there watching all these people put money in the little box at Jerusalem. And he watches this poor little lady, you know, put in her, you know, little dime or whatever it was she put in there. And he calls his disciples over. He said, now let me tell you what I see there. He said, these other people put in out of their wealth and didn't hurt them at all. No big deal. You know, she put in everything she had. She put it in faith. And what he did was he interpreted a very common experience. He saw it through those eyes. And so he was a watcher. He sat there and he watched, did you see this? Do you see those stones? Do you see this? You know, a sower went out to sow. And so he would always comment. So he saw this stuff. He saw who we are, what we're like, at our best and our worst. And he didn't go hide. He stayed all the way to the cross. So that we are thankful for. So let's close in a word of prayer. I've gone over again. Lord, we just thank you for your love. We thank you for your care for us. We thank you for coming to earth here, walking among us, putting a face on, putting a heart in our hands and our eyes. We can see what you learned, the way you lived, the way you cared for us. And that when you came, you didn't come as a king. You didn't come in royal splendor. So we would say, oh, it's just another king. Just another king. But you came as a savior, as a shepherd, as a healer, as an encourager, somebody that when we fail, you pick us up. And I just pray, Lord, that we would take that forward this week as we think about these things, and you know, that you walked among us, that this is real. Our hands have touched. People sat there and ate with you and fellowshiped with you like we will someday. And we just thank you for these hearts, and help these hearts, Lord, as they go through the week and bring us back together again at our next time. And stir us up, Lord. Stir us up to be more like you as we walk our hills, we walk our mountains. That we would see and reflect upon what you are doing in our lives, in the lives of those around us, and we can be a part and encourage people and do the right thing. So thank you so much for your love, forgiveness, acceptance, your delight in us. May we just realize your love for us more this week. Bless these souls and these hearts as they seek you more and grow in the grace and beauty and discovery and becoming more of who they really are before you. For your Son's sake we pray. Amen.